Marshall Cox? Ken Diggs? Dan Dives? Ernest George? Johnny Graham? We're getting a little feedback from someone's line. Please mute if you're not speaking. J.C. Hudgens?
Present.
Chris Moore?
Here.
Wayne Morris? Wayne, I know we had you on before. Are you still here? Wayne Morris?
Stewie.
Okay, just checking. Pete Nixon?
Yes, I'm here.
Don Porter? Tom Powers?
I'm here in my den where I always am.
Mark Sanford?
Yes, I'm here.
And Ed Tankard. Ed Tankard?
Pardon me. Yes, I'm here.
All right, so that gives us 8 on the committee, so we do have a quorum. So this is our meeting for tonight's Crab Management Advisory Committee meeting. I don't think we have any introductions or announcements to do. Thank you all for logging on to WebEx. We're adapting well to this new technological age. Our next item is approval of minutes from the February 19th, 2020 and the May 21st, 2020 meetings. We didn't do February the last meeting, so we can do those both tonight. Has everyone had a chance to review those? Are there any corrections to make? Otherwise, I believe we can. Can we, Mr. Chairman, can we approve by consensus?
I would think so, yes, ma'am.
All right, then does anyone have any corrections or suggestions? Hearing none, we'll consider both minutes approved. All right, for some new business. We're here to talk about the 2020 blue crab season. At our May 2020 meeting, the committee passed the motion, maintain status quo until the committee can meet in person in September or when feasible due to COVID-19 restrictions. We were a little optimistic then. So today is to revisit that recommendation and see if the committee still stands by that. I can give a little bit of data out of discussion. Now, this is not final harvest for 2019 or 2020 by any means. This is 2019, as was reported up through the end of September last year, and 2020, as reported through the end of September of this year. So, in 2020, we do have an issue that 220 to 330 licensees have not reported in those months. This is 100 to 150 fewer people reporting for each month this year than did by this time last year. So we have less of an idea of harvest than we did at this time last year. We can see so far March looks like an improvement over 2019, a drop in April, but But the problem with that reporting rate is we can't say there has been a difference because we don't know if that's an artifice of people just not reporting. These are the seasons since 2009. I've highlighted 2012, 2013, and 2016 as the only years where the season has stretched into December.
And Alexandra, can you go back to the catch slide just for a second?
Sure.
So you said 150 harvesters haven't reported last year, is that right?
Well, we can't tie it to specific people, but
Okay. Let's
say in one of those months, 220 licensees have not reported. Last year, it may have been 120 did not report.
Okay. So at least in terms of harvesters, that means that there may be as many as these numbers may represent a third less than what the actual catch is, because it looks like that would be about a third of the people haven't reported. Is that?
It depends, because some of those people may be reporting did not fish, or they reported did not fish last year and did fish this year. So it's really hard to tell. What scale this could increase by. Any other questions here?
Are there any proposals to change dates or anything on the season other than what I've heard recently? Is there any particular reason to change anything early or change bushel limits or anything that you folks are aware of?
I have not personally been approached by anyone wanting to change it. The reason we're revisiting it right now is because of that motion from May, where the committee did want to meet again, and if there's a case to make for extending the season, we'd want to hear it and hear what the reasoning is. You know, unfortunately, from that data, we can't tell specifically if COVID-19 has had an effect on harvest, on number of harvesters who've been able to go out. So we're kind of here to hear from you guys. Yes, and can I ask the committee, when you ask a question or make a statement, if you could just say your name first? It can be kind of hard to pick out particular voices over the phone.
Okay, well, that was Peter Nixon that I asked that question.
Yeah, thank you.
And it was Chris Moore who asked the earlier question.
Okay. And then this is just some information on December harvest. So this is the number of harvesters by month. You know, it's obviously the highest in July, decreases. And then in December, there hasn't been more than 100 harvesters. So from 2012, 2013, and 2016, the commercial crabbers averaged 15 trips a day, averaged 5,000 pounds a day total, and December generally made up 0.4% of the annual harvest.
This is Mark Sanger, but I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How does staff feel about an extension of the crab pot season until December 15th or the 20th of this year, is my question. Have y'all actually looked into that at all?
Well, based on the numbers I just read, it wouldn't make a large difference, and we'd be willing to entertain, you know, if people said it was affected by COVID for this reason or that reason. Keeping in mind that there were fewer crabs this year than last year, so we probably wouldn't expect that level of harvest again. And then our only other thing is, if the committee did want to make a proposal, we probably wouldn't entertain anything, any season later than it's been in previous years.
Right. Okay, I understand that. I can tell you this much from my standpoint. I was really honestly unable to sell any crabs whatsoever in the month of March. Now, I can't speak for anybody else, but I do know that it actually did affect some people. With that being said, I'd like to see an extension till at least December 15th. And I do know that there is a buyer on the Eastern Shore that Mayor has told me that he talked to Mr. Gear about this. David Bell, do you know of any conversation about that by any chance?
Mark, can you hear me from here?
No. Yes, yeah, I can.
Okay, I've talked to David several times. We talked today, and that's the main reason we're here today is to entertain.
Okay.
That's why we're here. You guys, when you approved what we were doing for this year back in February,
you said you wanted to come back in the fall and see how things were going with COVID-19 and maybe adjust the season accordingly. So that's why we're here today, and we're just showing this information and getting your input on whether or not you think it's a good idea and what would be an appropriate closing date. So that's the main that's the main discussion points right now.
Okay, my question is this. Do you really think it would be detrimental to the fishery to extend it based on the statistics that you have at this point?
Well, flipping a coin, who can answer? Alexis said it's less than 0.4%. The 3 years that we have opened into December, it's only been about 0.4% of the harvest. So, I would say no, because, I mean, we know we had a period that people weren't fishing because when we first had the outbreak, there was no market. So it probably wouldn't have that much of an impact.
And you can also also see in the graph on the left the number of harvesters who did take advantage of the last December extension was, 50 to 100 from 200 to 300 in November. So that's another question is, would a lot of people take advantage of that?
Right, exactly. And sometimes, co-management is discussed and sometimes it's not, but maybe, this may help the oyster fishery or taking people away from it. I know it's a very minimal number that actually may go oyster scraping or patentong or whatever they do, but I can tell you that the people that crab in my area, that's what they would do, but they prefer to stay and crab. So, I mean, that's four people right there. So, for what that's worth, I think it may take some pressure off the oysters. So, anyway.
Okay.
Any thoughts from anyone else on the committee? Yep, go ahead.
I agree with Mark. I think it would help out this year because what I'm hearing about the oyster market isn't too rosy, and it would just give a few people some more options. And the market was pretty bad in March, so I think it would help if it stays, warmer like it did last year, which who knows.
Alexa, JC?
Yeah. Go ahead,
Jim. Yeah, I agree with Mark. I think I don't have a problem with the limited amount of people that are going to crab in December, and it would give them an opportunity to make up for the slow season that we've had this year. I think to go back to March and April, I think it was the reason that a lot of people didn't crab was definitely COVID-19 related and market related, and it was also related to a reduction in the amount of crabs, such as the Mob Jack didn't have any crabs in it this spring, and I can't remember the last time that it wasn't some crabs where you couldn't make a good day's work in the Mojack. It was a pocket east of York's Spit that they worked on, they done fairly good at for a few weeks, and an area in the lower Rappahannock they done good on for 2 or 3 weeks. But I tell you, the area that I'm in up here at Gwenzawa, you know, I'm down probably over 50% on the female side than what I've been in the last 10 or 12 years. So I am seeing a reduction in the females, but an increase in juvenile males. So I think, you know, we got several problems, you know, we got some stock problems, and we definitely got this pandemic is still affecting things. So, if we can keep some people working into December, you know, I certainly wouldn't have a problem with that.
Anyone else?
Did anyone else from the committee want to chime in?
Anybody, this is Pete Nixon. Anybody other than what Mark said on the 15th or the 20th have any idea on the length of this extension, the 15th, the 20th, which the committee members seem to go for the most? Anybody?
Yeah, this is Mark Sanford. I mean, we need to take in consideration of the weather and stuff like that. And if you look at, I guess, the graph, the one furthest to the right, it goes to December 20th. I mean, really, honestly, the 15th to the 20th, I don't think there is a great harvest amount. So I'd really honestly like to see till the 20th. Maybe Alexa can, you know, maybe give me some numbers on that 5 days more compared to like the 15th to the 20th on the amount of crabs that were harvested in that time period.
I don't have the numbers in front of me. I can tell you it wasn't much because there was only the 1 year it went till the 20th. And even generally anything, the days from like the 10th to the 20th generally had the fewest landings anyway. It was usually those first few days spilling over to December. Then you see a lot in one day, which was clearly, that was a good weather day. But other than giving you that, I don't have those exact numbers.
Okay. Would staff object to December 20th?
You can make any motion.
Yeah, you guys can make a motion. I mean, to let you know, I mean, what we're looking for you is to say, yes, we'd like an extension, and we'd like to have a date associated with that so that we can start preparing that for the commission meeting for this month so we could take it to the commission with, you know, with what we want to recommend. I mean, you know, and what you, we would tell them what you want as well. So,
right.
So I think it's doable. I mean, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. I think it's, we've gone that far before in the past. I mean, you know, I think we're in the right ballpark with each other, so it's, you know, we're looking for this committee to go ahead and give us a recommendation for the dates they'd like to see it extended to, and then we'll work from there. For, you know. Okay.
And I believe it's also possible that the commission could hear a recommendation of the 20th and say, we don't want to approve the 20th, but we'll approve the 15th.
Right. You know, like I said, I mean, if we feel like, you know, really honestly that there's not a problem with the stock, then I'd like to see the 20th because there are going to be bad weather days, you know, where we're not going to be able to fish. And as you said, you didn't really see a significant harvest amount in those days. So I guess what you need from me is a motion. Is that correct?
If you want to, make a motion, it's up to you, then we'll take a second, and then we can take public comment.
Ron is in public.
Okay.
This is one fan. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
This is Ty Burns. I just saw somebody commented and said that the 20th is a...
Sorry.
20th is a Saturday.
Good
19th.
20th of December is a Sunday.
So you want to do the 19th.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. Can we make it till... It would be the 19th, actually. I'm sorry.
All right.
Hey, Ty.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. So, is there a motion?
Okay, yeah, I want to correct my motion. I want to make a motion that we extend the craft pot season until December 19th of this year is what my motion would be.
Is there a second?
I'll second it, Pete Nixon.
All right, so we can have some more discussion. I believe Rom wanted to say something. Rom, you're unmuted.
Yes, hi, everybody. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. I just want to make a couple comments on that proposition. And first, regarding the status of the stock, the eight zeros, the juveniles, were just slightly below the average this year, while the females and males, adults, were at or just slightly above the average. So in terms of the status of the stock, I think that's a reasonable proposition. I also did some quick calculations, and taking the highest number to harvest, daily harvest, which I'm estimating is around 7,000 pounds times 15 days, it would be about 105,000 pounds, not very much, as you mentioned before, Alexa. And even if you do 20 days, it's 140,000 pounds. So that my view coming from BIMS would be that it would not be unreasonable to have an extension of the season this year. And that doesn't even consider the possibility that harvest actually did drop due to COVID.
Okay, thank you, Rom. Does anyone else from the public want to comment? Type your name in chat, and then we'll be able to unmute you.
Hey, Alexa, this is Chris, just a question beforehand.
Yes.
My guess is we don't need it, because I think this is going to be pretty self-regulating. But in the past, I thought when we had extended the season, we had changed the bushel limits as well, and I wanted to see if staff had thought about that at all.
So it wasn't, without looking at the bushel limits for those years, it may have been that at that time the November bushel limit was decreased, so that carried forward. If it's certainly doable to propose this extension be at November's bushel limit, the April through November, or it could be at the March lower bushel limits. That would be up to the committee, the maker of the motion, if they wanted to make a recommendation either way.
This is Pete Nixon. Can I one thing for consideration here, just for somebody to think about? I'm sitting here looking at average temperatures for November and into December, and it's not going to be very cold. There's some freezing nights in December, but actually all the way through the 2nd of January, daily temperatures are averaging, it looks like, in the 50s. There's some 46-degree days. There's some 60-degree days. There's no 70-degree days projected. Of course, you know what that's worth.
Mm-hmm.
But same thing in, let me see if I can go back to November. This is just on AccuWeather. I'm sitting here looking at my stupid machine. But you know, the rest of October, you know, we're looking at days 70, 69, 70, 75, 73, 71, 75, 69, 68, all the way out through the end of the month. If that gives you any feel about what your ability might be to catch crabs. Let me go back to November, see what they say there. And I'll read you these out. First week of November, 69, 67, 58, 68, 63, 66, 59, 58, 67, 55 is the lowest one I see, 52 on the 28th, that's Thanksgiving. After that, it warms up a little bit, 64, 58, 54. Now, that's through the end of the, that's through the first 5 days of December. You know, the first of December is going to be 64. So there, if this is even close to correct, it doesn't look like we're going to have any real bad freezing weather to stop this. So we might be able to, you know, make a little bit up after that we didn't make in the spring. I know Mark and I crabbed in the same place this spring, and it was very disappointing for me. You know, you could count your crabs on one hand in a pot, which, you know, I've never seen it quite that poor at Linhay, but it was. I don't know what it would be like if we went down there. You know, you used to be good crabbing down there in October and November. I've seen one guy down there who used to crab. We'd be crab dredging, and he'd be still crab potting at Cape Henry. But this was, you know, I'm ancient, so this was way back in the day. Anyway, it doesn't look like we're going to have any really, real cold weather that would stop it in its tracks. There's some freezing weather at night, but not much.
Rom, you wanted to say something else?
This is just a quick clarification. When I was talking about the average numbers and so on, that's after the major management action. So the stock is those numbers that I was giving you mean that the stock's doing fairly well, stable.
All right. Was there any other question or comments from the public? If not, we can do a roll call to vote on the motion.
I got a quick question for you. Do I need to make a clarification on the bushel limits as far as that goes on this motion or not?
Up to you. It could help.
Yeah, I'd like to see the bushel limit stay the same as November, basically. And can we have a little discussion on this maybe before we actually take a roll call and vote, please?
Does the seconder of the motion have to agree to that, Mr. Chair?
Well, I'll agree to it.
Yeah,
this is Pete Nixon. I'll agree to that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Pete.
Any other thoughts on the bushel limit for December?
Alexa, JC?
Yep.
Mark, you're saying November limits you want to carry over into December. Is that the regular standard limit? Or are you talking about in November? That's not the reduced limit that we normally have in March and November, right?
Here's bushel limits. So I guess we need to have a little bit more discussion on this before we move on. That's my opinion. I want to know how staff feels about that. I mean, do you have a problem with that? I wasn't even thinking about that. I was, you know, so, I mean, does staff have a problem with that?
We don't have a problem with it. We're not the ones voting on it, you know, here or at commission. So,
right.
You know, it's up to you what recommendation you'll make and...
What about Rom? I mean, how does he feel? I'm trying to make this as easy as possible for everybody. I know usually at the meetings, the commissioners go with staff recommendations and then followed by the VIMS recommendations. And, you know, I want to streamline this as much as possible.
Yeah, Mark, I basically said that we wouldn't find that as unreasonable. And so we would certainly not be against the recommendation.
Okay. All right. That's great.
And if you want, I can throw up some numbers on that if my computer will allow me. Here's the usage of those higher bushel limits last year. So 19% of the total trips exceeded that reduced bushel limit. Only 2% of trips met the higher bushel limit.
Okay, so it was a minimal number that actually met their bushel limit.
Right.
Okay. All right.
That's right. Go ahead, Mark.
I guess I need to reaffirm my motion. Is that correct?
You can clarify it if you want.
Okay, yeah. Basically, my motion says we'd like to extend the crab pot season until December 19th, and that we would like to have the same bushel limits as we did in the 20 last year season, basically, is what it amounts to.
Okay, so the full
bushel
limit.
Just to say extend the November bushel, just use the same bushel limits as November.
Yeah. Yes, correct. Terminology, right. Continue on with the same bushel limits as the November bushel limits.
Okay. Are we ready for a roll call? Oh, sorry. I cut someone off.
No, this is Pete. I'll agree to that. You know, as far as the second goes.
All right. So, in favor of the motion, Ty Burns. Oh. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Yes, I'm in favor of it.
Okay. Marshall Cox. Ken Diggs? Dan Dyes? Ernest George? Johnny Graham? J.C. Hudgens?
Yes.
Chris Moore? Chris Moore?
Yes. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yep, got you.
Okay.
Wayne Morris?
Yes.
Pete Nixon?
Yes.
Donald Porter? Tom Powers?
Yes.
Mark Sanford? Mark Sanford?
Yes.
And
did you hear me?
Yep, got you. And Ed Pankard?
Yes.
Okay, that's unanimous then. Thank you all. The next item on our agenda is terrapin excluder devices. So, some reasons we're bringing this up today. As you all know, terrapins are often caught and killed in crab pots set in the shallow salt marsh, their ideal habitat. You know, it's not usually as extreme as in this picture, but it does happen, and that's often the images that accompany press releases. And at our, I think it was February meeting, Johnny Graham brought up that some processors have been having trouble selling Virginia blue crabs because of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. In 2019, we were downgraded from a good alternative to avoid. Their reasoning was there are serious concerns about the catch of diamondback terrapins, which are considered endangered or a species of concern. While the conservation measures for blue crab are rated moderately effective, management is rated ineffective overall because regulations to protect terrapins haven't been implemented. So here are TED regulations by state. New York and New Jersey make their regulations to recreational and commercial pots based on location. So in New York, if you're in a certain named body of water or a tributary or creek thereof, you have to have a TED. New Jersey, TEDs have to be in all pots in bodies of water less than 150 feet across at mean low water. Delaware and Maryland both require TEDs in all recreational pots, and Monterey Bay Aquarium kept those as good alternatives. I believe those two in New Jersey are both good alternatives. Virginia, we have TEDs incentivized for the recreational five-pot licenses. You can pay less for a license if you put TEDs in your pots. And in North Carolina, starting in 2021, they're creating terrapin management areas, and all pots within those will have to have a TED. So staff is proposing requiring a plastic or wire TED in all recreational crab pots. That includes the five pot licensees, as well as everyone fishing two pots, which you're able to do without permit or license by law. Plastic could be those pre-made, the orange TEDs you've all seen. Wire allows you to make your own. VIMS actually has a brochure to teach the public how to make their own. And the timeline on this will be a public hearing in December to make a regulation effective in March 2021. Does anyone have any questions?
Hi, this is Tom Powers. I have an objection for a couple reasons. Number one, if this is really necessary that we do this, it needs to be by waterway or area, not just recreational and commercial. Five-pot recreational potter will go out and set their pots right next to commercial pots. Why are they necessary? That the recreational potter has to have them and the commercial one doesn't. Number one. Number two, with a two-pot license or the two-pot no license, I don't know how you're going to communicate that to the public effectively and have people who have had crab pots on their docks for years realize that they have to do anything about this. And I've always had this problem, especially the concept of if I'm in the Pecosin River and I take my rowboat out and set two pots out there, and I'm right in the middle of a line of commercial pots, why do I have to do something different than they do? Why is it more of a risk for my pots than their pots? And the same thing goes, I mean, Pecosin Flats out there on the grass beds, that's a prime area for terrapins. And there's very little, if any, recreational pots out there. It's all commercial.
Can I answer one of those?
Go ahead.
Commercial people check their pots every morning for the most part. I can't tell you how many people I've seen kick a pot off their dock and look at it about once a week. I think that plays a big role in it. I understand what you're saying, but if you're working every day, you're more likely to get through all your gear before something drowns in it.
Alexander, this is Chris. I'm a little confused as to why, if the impetus for this is the Monterey Bay piece, this would change the Monterey Bay scoring at all, because recreational pots obviously don't feed into the commercial fishery.
However, Maryland and Delaware also follow these same regulations, and they're rated as good alternative. So as long as we have management measures in place to protect Diamondback terrapins, which apparently includes TEDs and recreational pots, they rate that more effective management than we have.
So you're putting restrictions on recreational crabbers to benefit commercial crabbers. I'm confused as to where that's fair.
Tom, it's just a lot of, you've got several people on the phone, Rom, and a few other people have done some of this work, and I've done some work on this in the past, and it is more of a problem in the recreational fishery. And that's just, you know, everybody we've talked to, they've all said it's more of an issue in the recreational fishery. The two pot people, you're right, we're going to have to dig out reef push on this, and that's on us. And, you know, those people hang those pots off the dock and they can sit there all week. So, we're looking what Maryland and Delaware both did, and it's, we feel this is an effective measure to get in part of this problem, because a lot of those recreational fishermen off their docks, these terrapins that are being caught a lot of times in close proximity to the marsh edge. And where's the dock? Right at the end of the marsh, right at the edge of the marsh. So, we've got Ron on the phone and a few other people that may want to speak to that. Kirk Havens is on the phone as well about, you know, is it more of a problem recreational than it is commercial?
Ed Tanker, can I just chime in here with one point that I think is somewhat relevant? And this may be anecdotal, but on a regular basis, I've even been with the commissioner when we run over untended pots. I was out of Folly Creek surfing out of there last week, and I counted, I don't know how many untended pots. They were commercial. So they've got some folks here on the seaside in particular that don't pick up their pots when they decide they're finished with them. That's got to be part of the computation somewhere in here.
Yeah, I got a question. This is Mark Sanford. There was a study done on the Chipkin turtles a few years back. Could Rom tell us a little information about what that study was? Was he in charge of that or not?
Yeah, so Mark, I can tell you about the study. Basically, it was with disaster relief money. We were looking at eeler pots and commercial crab, hard crab pots. We did the study over 2 years. We did it at 16 different locations, two crabbers in each. We did it over four seasons. And in all those pot sets, thousands of pot sets, I think there was a total of three terrapins caught. One was in shallow water in one of the trips, and two were in a single pod, actually, in Lynn Haven. So our conclusion regarding the BRDs or TEDs is that they're not required. We don't believe they're required in the commercial fishery. Now, that there's a caveat to that, and you can see that's why what North Carolina is doing. There are certain shallow water areas where there are crab potters, and there they will catch terrapins. So, and then the second thing is that what we do know, this is from anecdotal information, is that, as most of you know, that those two pot holders, personal dockside pots, those do catch terrapins. We've heard some pretty bad information on that. So we're primarily concerned about the two pots. And we do believe that is the least that we can do. Now, whether or not we need to establish terrapin management areas, that's going to require a bit more work. And you can go to people like Randy Chambers, who's a terrapin expert, at William & Mary, who could actually maybe provide some advice on where that would be. But for right now, we definitely do not believe that there's any need for pets in commercial craft pods, and there is in two pods. Now, if the FOP pod licenses that they're in deep water, probably don't need them, but I don't know how you're going to be able to regulate that.
Thanks, Rob.
I've been working up in Wind Haven for 40 years, and I know quite a few of the recreational potters, and I've talked to them over a year's time. And I can personally tell you that most of them tell me they put their pots out and they fish them once a week. And that is what the problem is. I fish my pots every day, and I'm not pinpointing a person that may or may not have issues with terrapins, but what I am saying is commercial fishermen usually go to the pots every day because that's their livelihood. And the recreational crab potter wants to have crabs on the weekend. And as far as like the two pot recreational crabber, what I would suggest is maybe VMRC ought to look into having all recreational pots with the number put on it. Because I know recreational potters in Lynn Haven, they don't put numbers on their pots, on the two pot licenses, only on the five pot. That would be my input on this.
This is Ron Lipsius again. I just wanted to add that I think what I would consider a fairly effective way to go about this for the two pot or maybe even the five pot recreational pots is that I had a student who did a study on this some years ago, and she was the one who went out and tried to get a voluntary adoption of the BRDs, but that just was a bit difficult. But now if you go to the stores like Ace Hardware or whatever, and then you require anyone who's selling pots to install BRDs, selling pots to recreational folks, then I think that would be a pretty simple avenue by which you could get that accomplished.
I was going to say Ace Hardware here on the Eastern Shore and even Marshall's Manufacturing, every recreational pot they sell now, whether it's a little half pot or a full-size pot, they put those TEDs in all of them that I've seen in the last year or so.
Yeah, I don't see them over here. Again, this is the Williamsburg area in Gloucester. I've gone into the Aces there. Don't see them there, so.
I looked the last time I was at Bass Pro, and they had them in a plastic bag inside the pot. So they weren't already installed. They were there if you wanted them, but I'm sure some people get the bag and just kind of toss it off to the side.
So I think if we're going to implement something like this, two things. Number one, it should be, if you're buying new pots, you get them put in. But the problem with that is, at least what Jack Travelstead said when we first talked about this, when he was still head of fisheries, so that must have been, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, was the agency does not have the authority to mandate that what somebody sells. They only have the authority to mandate what goes in the water. I can have a crab pot sitting in my front yard or on my side yard with no TED in it if it's, with no coal rings in it. And it's still a legal crab pot for my side yard. It's not illegal until it goes in the water. And the agency didn't have the authority to tell the stores you have to sell it this way. So that's one issue. The other issue is if you're going to initiate a mandate on recreational crabbers having to have TEDs in their crab pots, you need to make it at least have some areas that commercial crabbers have to do the same. That everybody who crabs, for example, on Pocosin Flats, where it's averages 2 feet deep at low tide, just deep enough for crabbing. You got to have TEDs in those areas. Those areas are loaded with terrapins, I know, because I see them in my kayak and stuff.
That's something we can look into. I'll tell you, it wouldn't be for March if we did, because any area any, you know, within these coordinates or in an area this deep or in a creek this wide is going to require a lot of surveying. It's going to require the issuance of maps that crabbers can check whether or not they're in areas, maps that law enforcement can use in enforcement. So, you know, it's something we can look into.
I'm not suggesting you do all areas uniformly. I'm suggesting you pick a half a dozen areas, let Ron pick them, and say these areas you can't do it. You have to have a TED in these areas. If you're going to make it a mandate for recreational, and I, again, don't see how you're going to get a mandate for recreational crabbers enforced effectively.
This is Pat. We tried to do something.
Can I?
We tried to do it voluntarily by having a license for those 5 pod licensees where we've incentivized by saving $10 by putting in the, having the pets in your pods. I run into gentlemen when I've been out fishing and I said, hey, how you doing? I talked to them and I said, oh, so you have the pets in your trap? He goes, yeah, I paid double the price. And he pulled it up and he goes, see, they're right there. And he's pointing to the culverts. He didn't have them. So people are actually going and buying these licenses, you know, buying the less expensive license because we have an option for them.
And even then, I think like 60% of the recreational 5-pot licenses sold are the more expensive, so people don't have to put the tents in.
And I think if we require this, the market will start, you know, yeah, we can't force Ace Hardware to sell them with tents in them, but if it becomes a requirement, they will start selling them, or nobody will be buying crab pots on them.
The other issue is, I don't know that the agency has the authority to require the 5-pot license people to do it. That would have to come with code.
No, it doesn't.
Because it says in code that there's two licenses you can buy.
I checked with council, and council said we cannot offer a license. We can decide not to sell a license. I've already approved that through council.
The code says we can have up to, we can offer these licenses for up to this number of pods with these conditions. So it's not a have to, it's we may.
Okay.
Council's already approved that. We've gone through that already.
But that deals with the license that you sell now. What about the 2 pods that are allowed by statute? Because that's not a license.
We're requiring it. We'll have it in there that says all recreational pods. The regulation will say all
pods for used for recreational purposes.
Takes care of the two. Now we are in full agreement. That's going to be the difficult part because how do we reach out to those people? And that's on us.
And the other question is, what do you say to those people when they say, I can no longer catch jumbo crabs?
There's been quite a few studies. None have shown, none that I found, I should clarify, have shown any difference in the size of crab caught between pots with Teds and pots without Teds.
Doug Jenkins brought in crabs and a Ted and demonstrated that crabs that he had in his paper sack could not fit through the Ted. There were jumbos. There were big crabs. They're the ones everybody really wants to catch. So yes, you are restricting them to a maximum size.
Depends on what size head is in there. What size head is two of the plastic designs.
This is Mark Chambers again. Are there dimensions in which a TED has to be?
There are. We would be looking at the. Well, we're currently looking at the Maryland and Delaware size, which is 1 3/4 inch by 4 3/4 inch. New Jersey, I believe, uses a 2 by 6 inch TED. North Carolina uses a different style of TED. They use a South Carolina, which is a domed top, so that sizing is a little different. I don't have that dimension on hand.
Okay, so my question is this. Would we require a standard? What size are we talking here, I guess, is what it comes down to.
Right now, we'd be looking at the 1¾ by 4¾. That shows the highest exclusion of terrapins.
Okay. And there's no study.
Big crash.
Well, that's my question. Was there ever a study done on size of crabs that are excluded by that at size?
Yes.
I can't say about the 2x6, but work that I'm familiar with, I know the TEDS will basically keep out sponge crabs as well.
I can send to the committee, there's a story map out of VIMS that looks at terrapin studies along the coast, and I know that some of those studies did include a 2x6 compared to 1¾ by 4¾ to the 2x6. I don't have names of those studies offhand, but I have read through them.
Something that Pat, I think, just said. So now you're also saying we're going to exclude orange sponge crabs from recreational products because they can't get in the TED either.
I haven't seen anything specifically about sponge crabs.
That's what
in the study?
Said that study was done in Georgia.
Okay.
What was that?
Just a reminder to stay on mute if you're not currently speaking.
So, JC, you're not going to see any sponge crabs up in ahead of these creeks where most of these terrapins are anyway, and most of the recreational pots. They're just not going to be up there. The water's not salt enough.
You'll see them all inside Lynnhaven near the mouth of the Lynnhaven River where there's lots of here. You'll see them all inside Pretty Lake where people put crab pots off of here because there's no commercial crabbing in the middle of the creek.
Yeah. Hey, this is Bart Sanford. I can tell you about Lynnhaven and where the terrapins are. So, you know, the way I look at this is maybe we should come up with a turtle occlusion device that would be bigger, not the smaller, but maybe we should go with the larger. As far as Lynnhaven goes, what I found is there are no, like JP said, there are no sponge crabs in the heads of these creeks. Is it set in stone the size of the TED that we have to put in the pots? Maybe we should go with the larger size if we have to do this to make sure that, you know, our product is sellable.
So far, all we have is a recommendation. We can provide all information to the commission.
Okay. And do we really need to vote on this tonight? It sounds to me like there really needs to be a lot more discussion than what we're having about this.
Are you saying this would require another meeting?
So, Alexa, if I could comment, we had that our two-year study that also included pots with and without BRDs, and we did it on feeler pots, we did it on hard crab pots, and so on. And so what we could do for the next meeting is we could actually give everyone the results that we got from all that, the full study, and Doug Jackson, the crabbers, involved in that. So we can tell you what the effects were, and I can tell you one thing that struck me is that it looked like those pots with BRDs, even though they had a slightly larger average size of crab, not the feeler pots. The feeler pots, by the way, had on average bigger feeler crabs in them, we think, because they exclude very large arm crab. But for arm crab pots, it looked like there was a trade-off, even though there were slightly smaller, and I emphasize slightly smaller crab sizes, it toxic ERDs, the total biomass was made up by more of the smaller but legal sized crabs. So, but anyway, that's just my recollection. I can provide a summary to the committee next meeting.
This is Pete Mitch. You mind if I interject another thought about this?
Go ahead.
Have most members of the committee seen these things installed in the pond or the crab pot? Anybody have a comment on that? Because what I've seen is it's a square piece of wire or plastic or rectangle shape that's inserted in the funnel at a point wherever it fits. And there's a whole lot of people on this bay that have a particular way that they like the shape of their funnels. And this pretty much defeats that altogether. You might as well just put a rectangle hole in the side of a crab pot and have it be just as effective. So you've lost the efficiency or the catchability of a lot of crab pots. I've seen pots that can have funnels in them that are awful thin, and they catch nothing. And I've seen pots that have blue-shaped funnels, and they're on the right angle, and they've got the right taper, and they'll outcatch those other pots 2 or 3 to 1. If you're going to require people to put these terminal glitter devices in their funnels, you change the catching ability of the pots much less or along with the size restriction. You cannot get a large crab to go through this pot. They're just not going to fit. You're going to eliminate a certain quality of crab. And if you come up with an area restriction for everyone, you're going to take some large crab right out of the market. Because a lot of times a year, you don't find those large crabs in some of the shallower water or up on the side. You're not just sitting in the middle of the creek. You're up on the edge. Plus, a lot of places where the channel goes down the middle, you're not allowed to crab in the channel. So you're forced into the shallow water. I hate to see something like this morph into something that's going to be placed on commercial crab. And that looks like where we're headed, down to this. I understand the concern about these little turtles, but what we're trying to accomplish here tonight, according to what I heard from Pat, was we're trying to eliminate people being able to be exempt for a few dollars more. And as I remember the original presentation, this was all caused by people that not only, like Mark said, only fish their pots once a week, on the weekend when they're off or when they have time to pull with crab, but it was also weekenders in upper parts of the bay. I think there's more of these in Maryland than there are in Virginia, and they would come down to their summer home for the weekend, and they would set their pot, and then they would fish in for a time or two, and then they would go home and leave them. I think some of it is an educational thing, telling people to take their pots out of the water, put that right on their license when they get it, and Mark had a good suggestion that if you're going to have any pots overboard, they ought to be identified. Unless they're just hanging off your gear, then you can tell exactly, which residence the pots belong to. But if they're going to set them off of their pier in the water, some people don't have their pier, they need to have an ID number.
Pete, this is Pat. One word that you said right away struck home with me. You said the word marketability. In a recreational fishery, there should be no marketability.
I'm getting down to the tail end of my season, and every customer that comes up, the first thing they ask is, do you have any jumbos? It's got to be a joke. I'll call Jamie on the phone and find out what's going on, and the first thing I say is, do you have any jumbos? Well, they're all sold in the first, they're not even just jumbos, they're just number one quality crabs. And, they're gone in the first hour. People sit at our place and then, you go down there on Saturday, there'll be a dozen cars, there are people fighting, they're getting ready to get mad at each other to get in line to get those big crabs before they're gone. So, you tell me.
But Pete, why would marketability be an issue in the recreational fishery?
Well, I don't think it would be. I'm talking about the thing morphing onto what Tom was talking about. If anybody's going to fish in shallow water, he thinks the commercial crab ought to have them as well.
That's where that comes in.
I agree with what Pete said with this. I don't think that any of this was supposed to be getting into what we're getting into when Johnny brought it up. And you'll not make a living with all these things in your box, I can tell you that right now. It'll ruin it.
Again, you said a living. We're doing this just for recreational.
Yeah, I know, but it's like Pete saying, everyone's bringing commercial into this.
But, you know,
he can correct me if he wants to, but I heard Tom say that if he was going to be forced onto recreational crabber, he wanted to see areas in the bay or the rivers or creeks or wherever where you couldn't fish any crab pod without a turtle excluder in, commercial or recreational. Am I correct in what you said, Tom? Is that right?
Yes, that is my opinion, but and I'm sure that there are a lot more recreational fabbers that will be calling their congressmen or delegates and state senators saying the same thing. I mean, it's a question if you're going to do something, do it. But don't just say we're going to pick the recreational fabbers and, oh, you're going to get a poorer quality catch because you've got this turtle excluder in there. You're going to be less efficient because you don't have good funnel shape, as Pete said. I mean, this is let's just screw over the little guy.
Tom, did you hear what Ron said? He said it's mostly, you know, from the data they have, it's mostly a recreational issue.
So fine, let's get an educational program out there to pull your pots off your pier when you're not fishing them.
We've had a few people say they'd like to make public comment. Madeline Reinsel, did you want to make a comment? We're unmuting you now. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, great. I work with Maddie Chambers at White and Mary. I just wanted to point everyone towards a story map that we created earlier in the year that just shows a summary of a lot of different studies and the conclusions that we found from those studies. And so a lot of the story map is sort of directed towards the general public, but I think you all might find the end of it interesting just because of that summary that we have. So. Yeah, I just wanted to
find
that.
If you have the, unless you did she send it?
I'll send it.
Okay, we have someone putting that in chat now that people can look up if they're interested. So make sure you copy that link over before the meeting ends. And Daniel Knott wanted to make a comment. Can we unmute him? Daniel, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I worked with, I got about 80 TEDs from Randy Chambers at the beginning of the season after he spoke with the Watermen's Association about these, just to test them for myself. The test got cut short just because of COVID and I pulled all my pots. But when I did have them in, I purposely had to go up inside of Davis Creek, if anybody's familiar with that, over by New Point Comfort. That's the only place I've had any interaction with terrapins. So I put 19 pots out there. I had two of them that were just randomly spaced in there with TEDs in them and would move them around. And the average crab, just over a few day period, was in all the pots without TEDs, was 7.5 crabs. The ones with the TEDs were less than 2 crabs. So it definitely severely impacted my my catch. And I changed the placement in the funnels. I run 4 funnel pots and, I changed the placement in the funnels just to make sure it wasn't a placement issue, but it definitely severely impacts the catch. But I certainly think based on what Rom, the data Rom has, I'd love to see that, and then just a better study on what the actual impact is, and that's recreational or commercial. But I had to go way up to the creek, and the object you just built terrapins. So the only interaction I could have was getting way up in the creek. So I think that supports the recreational use of these things. Thank you.
I do have here a few studies that were done. So, two studies in Chesapeake Bay saw no significant effect on crab catch with TED. Two studies on the York said that the pots with 1¾ by 4¾ had CPUE 50% less than pots with no TEDs. There were two studies in North Carolina and Maryland found catch in pots with TEDs around 27% less. So, you know, unfortunately, the studies are kind of all over the place, that there can be no effect. There can be up to 50% effect. Were there any other public comments? You can type in chat if you'd like to speak.
Yeah, this is Mark Sanford. So basically what it comes down to, we're not accepted by the Monterey Bay Sustainable Fisheries thing, correct? Is what they're saying, that they should not buy blue crab from the Chesapeake Bay.
Correct. Any the Virginia portion. So any consumer who has one of those little cards, they look up Virginia pot blue crab from pots and see a red avoid.
So this is really not going to be mandated by VMRC that we have to put TEDs in. Is that correct? We have basically a marketing problem because they're saying basically this is a non-sustainable fishery, based on the fact that our interaction with terrapins. Is that correct?
It does go slightly beyond Monterey Bay. You know, most organizations do rank diamondback terrapins as species of concern. The Department of Wildlife Resources has that it's a severely, impacted species. So there are, you know, ecological concerns we're also trying to address here.
Right.
But
it's
also marketing.
Okay. So this is basically marketing. It's not so much, it sounds, you know, I mean, from my standpoint, I know that I stay away from terrapins. I know where they're at in my name. I know where they live. I've been there, I've done that, etc. This is more of a marketing problem. And as far as like the conservation matter, this is not something that's really, honestly, we need to look into further, but we don't have to do anything tonight. Is that correct?
It is a conservation measure as far as terrapins, considering they are either threatened or endangered in different states. It is a marketing thing. At least Johnny was on the call, because Johnny Graham proceeds when he brought this up before.
It'll be in the minutes from the February meeting.
Our attention, and he was already seeing an impact to his business.
Right.
Now, you know, requiring it, that's one of the reasons why we're doing this. You know, there's also the conservation measure as well. So it's not the only reason we're doing it. We're doing it for conservation and for the market.
There was one study, I don't have the name of it, I think it might have been Upperman, that said if every dock owner in Virginia put out one crab pot, putting TEDs in each of those crab pots could save, I want to say 900,000 terrapins, or 90,000. It was, you know, significant. And that was just by counting the number of docks, assuming that most people have, you know, that one or two crab pods on their dock, which they do check on the weekend or check on the holidays.
But that's an inflated study, because I can, at least on the river I live on, because I can tell you that most of the people who have docks don't put crab pods up on them. About 10%, 20% might, but not 100%.
Tom,
you
I can refute that based on where I live. Everyone has crab pots hanging off their dock where I live, so I guess it depends on where you live and the demographics.
Yeah, it's because if you set them out here, you only get 3 or 4 crabs in the pot.
Kind of sounds like one of those COVID death studies.
Okay, well,
basically what I'm getting at is this is something that we need to look further into, but the first step towards mitigating the problem would be doing something with the recreational crabber. And I know, you know, I don't want to discriminate against any user group whatsoever, but I think a study has been done and has proven that recreational crabbers at this point have been a problem. And what I would suggest is maybe VIMS could possibly do another study to look into the commercial harvester and what they actually do.
I think Ron's already done.
Yeah, but when you do that, remember that the commercial harvesters leave their pots in for 48 hours every Sunday.
Yeah, well, then I guess
check them on Saturday morning and don't check them again until Monday morning.
Then I guess what we need to do is change the law to where we can crab pot on Sunday.
That's not
it. I'd like to have the five pot license on Sunday because recreational crabbers recreate on Sunday, but that's another issue.
We need to take this in steps, and it seems to me like a study was done proving that recreational crabbers are the problem at this point, and that we need to move forward and look into the commercial fisheries. That's what we need to do. We need to do something positive.
From Sam Knott, it looks like Randy Chambers.
I do not support the concept of just doing something on the recreational side that's mandatory. I think education would be good and all that. But the other thing is, if you're going to do something, you need to do it with a larger 2-inch by 6-inch excluder, not the 1 3/4 inch. Can you pull the slide up you just said about their effectiveness, the catchability slide?
There's a lot more data about this that I did not include, including comparisons of terrapin savings between the 1 3/4 and the 2 6. I think 1 3/4 may have prevented, 95% of terrapins from entering, while the 2 by 6 may have been 60 to 70%. Again, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but I can definitely get that to you.
Yeah. So, if you look at these numbers, it's 82% reduction. That's like don't even bother trying to set your pots out anymore.
That's reducing terrapin catch.
No significant effort in the...
terrapin.
Okay. Sorry. Never mind. Yeah, so 50% less than catch per unit effort, 27% less. And the Chesapeake Bay studies, were they in years when we didn't have big crabs again? And were they in areas that had sponge crabs? You're just telling the recreational crabber we don't want you to try anymore.
This is Chris. I actually have a couple pots that I use a lot that are rigged with TEDs, and I actually catch a lot of sponge crabs in them. Sometimes it's almost all sponge crabs, so I know they will go in there. I generally think I agree with Mark's statement. I think starting with the recreational is the good place to start because those pots do tend to sit a long time. Turtles do drown in 30 to 45 minutes, so it doesn't really matter a whole lot whether it's a recreational pot or a commercial pot. If it's in the area where turtles interact and it gets in once, it's probably going to drown. But I think, again, Mark's right. The next step may be, are there some areas that we need to avoid? People that I talk to reference Eastern Shore a lot, where there's areas where there's lots of tent interactions. The Lynn Haven's a good example. There are areas in there where you are very, very, very likely to get terrapins in your pots. There's other areas where you're not likely at all to have that happen, and folks I talk to confirm that as well. So I don't know if we need to vote this in December, but I think this is recreation was the right step first, and we need to get some additional info from Rob or other folks, Randy, who work on this to see if there's some other areas that have really, really high concentrations of terrapins, and those areas may need some additional protections, but the recreation is a good first start, because I do think the data very well bears out that that's where a lot of the interactions currently are.
This is Ed Tankard. Again, I would say I agree with Chris. You know, one of the things you're seeing, I think, with the socially conscious consumer and how this sentiment can come around from that social responsibility playing out in the exclusion of buying shellfish or fish from people or states that are not that don't have laws that are sustainable, I think also plays out with our own recreational people. I don't think they want to catch terrapins. I think they want to be good stewards. So I don't see recreational people being up in arms about conservation of a fishery that they like, or a species of turtle that they also like. So I don't see it as a bad thing for the recreational person at all. Good for our commercial crabbers. I just see on the seaside a lot of terrapin, and I see a lot of pots that will just hang out and not be pulled, and I know they've got terrapins in them. I think we need to do something about people who don't tend their pots.
So money talks. Oh, Alexa, what was the ratio of people who paid an extra $10 for their 5-pot license?
I want to say it was 60% pay more to not have PEDs.
So money talks. That's what recreational crabbers who pay for their license want. Why do I say that? Because they pay the extra $10. The other thing about those 5-pot licenses is I would bet that the majority of the 5-pot licenses are used off of a boat in deeper water. They're not used on a pier. So I think that exception should be left in if you're going to do it for the one ticket. Okay? Or maybe make it so that if it's on a pier, it's got to have this, got to have a TED. If I take mine and roll it out into the middle of the river, why would I need one? I'm in 10 feet of water.
Well, Tom, up the Elizabeth River where I live, we've got one guy up there. I don't know exactly how he does it, but he fishes about 20 pots on recreational licenses. I think he's got a couple buddies or his father or mother-in-law or whatever they all have different licenses on. He puts them right out amongst all the rest of them. And some of the water's not too deep, and some of it is. It all depends on how close to the bank you get. But they fish them whenever they feel like it. You know, when the credit is real good, he might fish them a couple days a week. Other than that, I hardly ever see him, but the pots are out there.
You know, I'd like to talk to you later about that individual's name, because the law says that it's 5 per person on the boat. And he can't say he's fishing 4 or 3 other people's pots. Those folks have to be on the boat with him.
Yeah, I understand that. But
it's a very common occurrence. It's pretty common. So.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been doing it for years, and they've never pressed him about it. But I just see the pots out there all the time.
Yeah.
So he doesn't necessarily go way out in the channel. But he'll go up and down the creek from his house. You know, he might stay close to the bank, but he'll go east and west. You know, not out in the middle. Like I said, he gets in amongst everybody. And they'll be there for a month of business and they'll be gone. Now, we don't seem to have a terrible problem way up here. So I don't know, I've never looked at his pots or even see if he has any kids in him or not, but I would imagine that he probably booked the license that he doesn't need.
Is there anything else on this?
But let me ask one more question. You said that, and I've got to change back and look at the minutes, but you said Johnny Graham brought this up because he's having some kickback on moving product to, I don't know, I would imagine it's grocery stores that, you know, advertise with this Monterey Bay stuff. If we do this in recreational pots, we get a accredited by the Monterey Bay, not doing it in all pots, but just in recreational pots. Am I correct in what I heard?
I can't promise that, but based on what they approved and what they didn't approve, I would think yes. I have been I struggled with.
In other words, they think buying Maryland product is fine because they've required it in all recreational pots, but Virginia's is not because we don't.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they did that to a lot of states. I mean, I have fought for about 8 years in two different states over this about how they did this methodology and whether or not, you know, I disagree with it when I was in Georgia and I disagree with it now. And but it's on there. It does have influence. It has influence on marketability. And
oh, listen, I believe that J.C. Hutchins can talk to you about that. We went through a whole deal with trying to get some stuff through, even with this aquarium down here, about sustainable products in Virginia. I'm well aware of it, and, you know, like you say, a lot of people pay attention to that. I guess their virtue signaling is what it amounts to, but I guess they feel like they're doing some good if they shun some products.
Yeah, I talked to the editors and I said, look, we have an incentive for the five pots, and they said it's not enough. You're not doing enough. So
they said it's not doing enough.
It wasn't enough what we have in place now.
Right. But what is enough? Did they enumerate what would be enough?
No, I mean at the time I was just trying to justify why we went from a good alternative to a void. I was trying to ask them what their rationale was for.
And what is Maryland's law that they approve of? Is Maryland's law that they have this 4 3/4 or whatever it is, 2 3/4 by whatever it is?
Maryland has two. The best fishery they evaluated was the Maryland trout line. They said that was the best because obviously it's not. The way it's totally different. But because they require the excluded device in all the recreational pots.
Well, recreational pots are allowed in the rivers in Maryland?
Yes. No.
No.
They are.
Well, where are they allowed? They're allowed in the rivers, but not the beds.
I think someone actually put that in chat earlier. Jim Murray said, Maryland requires Teds and crab pots from docks. There is no recreational use of commercial crab pots other than by waterfront owners.
Okay.
I got you. So they only allow recreational pots on their piers or right on the shore by the waterfront owners. Mm-hmm. And they require Teds and all of those, but it's a very minimal amount of pots, correct?
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, it's probably not many. So what they really are going by, Maryland being approved, is the fact that they have a trout line fishery in their rivers and only crab pots in the open waters.
Delaware?
Trout line is considered as a totally separate fishery from the crab pot fishery.
Delaware is also a good alternative. I don't know their specific regulations other than Teds are required in all recreational pots.
Well, let's do this. Let's get a statement from Monterey Bay of what they really think they can tolerate, because otherwise this is liable to be wasted energy anyway. You understand what I'm getting at? If we're going to do this and force this on the people around the waterfront, and then Monterey Bay says, oh, well, that's really not good enough because Maryland has a trout line fishery in their rivers, and that's all, and that's what we want you to have in Virginia, in order for us to put our stamp of approval on your product, then where do we go from there? If that's why we're addressing this again, is simply to satisfy those folks, that we're going to have to sit down and reevaluate the whole fishery with a question mark at the end of that remark?
I mean, like you said, the marketability is one issue that we're addressing here. We're also dealing with the conservation of terrapins, which has been shown that the recreational pots have more effect on the conservation of terrapins.
Right. I understand. We went all through this a couple of years ago. I don't think you had gotten here yet, but we went through all this discussion, I don't know how many years back it's been. We had pictures of them. And Ron, how long ago has that been? You had one of your proteges up here with you, a nice lady, do the whole thing. Ron, are you here?
That was 10 years ago, I'm pretty sure. I know what you're referring to. That was Megan Rook.
Right. And she had photographs of, you know, you'd see up in Maryland, I don't know if these were in Virginia or not, but you'd see as many as a dozen or more of those little guys in there dead as a stone, people had left it all week long, and they had just accumulated in there. You know, I think the point is, like Chris was talking about, you'll catch some that will die, you know, in an overnight set because they're only going to live no longer than they can poke their head and breathe. But it's not going to be cumulative of days after day after day after day after day in these waters that, you know, where there's a lot of them there. And, you know, there's more of them in Maryland than there are here. Proof of that is, you know, that's their University of Maryland symbol, the Maryland terrapins. We don't have the Virginia terrapins or anything like that down here. There's just not that many of them. There are some, but nothing like there apparently is up there. If we're doing this as conservation, then you have to do what the conservation science says do, and that is that long-term pots overboard do more harm than pots that are fished on a regular basis. And that's the recreational person that has a summer home, or even the one that lives on the water and only wants to fish his pots on the weekends. Now, up here where I live, people don't leave their pots overboard. They pull them up on the pier. I got, you know, neighbors all around here. I live on the water. And when they're not doing anything with them, you see them sitting on the pier. And up the river from me, there's a little group of Asian folks who live in housing development, and they have pots all over that place. But there's only a couple of these. But, you know, there's probably 20 residents that have a community pier, and they go down on the weekend, all their pots are overboard. You go by there on Monday, and they're all on the top. So they're not leaving them. But there's a lot of those people that will live in wherever and come down and... I guess it's more up the bay or up the rivers than it is down here. We don't have a lot of weekend homes down here anywhere. And then leave the stuff and go home. And I guess they come back for the end of the next week, shake all the dead stuff out, date them up, and do it again. But the pots, they're not terrible if you leave them overboard all the time. I don't know what the answer to this is. If it's purely conservation, and they're going to have to get the pots out of the water or put a thermal device in it. If it's to satisfy Monterey Bay, I don't know if we can do that or not without having a trot line fishery in the river. That's what they want. You know, and Ron, you did just the opposite several years ago when you cordoned off the whole bay with sanctuary. You ran everybody up in the river. You know, we can't cram anywhere else. So you got to stay in the river. So what are you going to do? Actually, if you go to Troutline, you'll pretty much eliminate crab pot fishing in Virginia, except for a little bit in the spring and the fall where you can get out. That's where we are.
All right. Well, we'll keep looking into this. I'll dig up my editor, Monterey Bay. I mean, we were dealing with interns left and right, but I'll try to get a hold of somebody there. Ask them what they think.
Yeah, and their document might have recommendations. We can look into that as well. So thank you all for the discussion.
Yeah,
Am I cutting someone off?
No.
All right. Our next agenda item, some research we're hoping to look into with biodegradable, with escape panels, not just biodegradable. You know, you've seen this before. So we first studied the VIMS model of degradable biopanels in 2017. We had another study on them planned for 2019. Unfortunately, the panels were not made available to us at that time, so that stalled. But we're looking into a new cooperative study, hopefully in 2021, to test a variety of degradable materials, which could include natural twine, including jute, cotton, sisal, or hemp, untreated steel wire, untreated wood, I know pine is popular for this, and maybe the biopanels. So we've been looking at a study from 2005 in North Carolina. I believe they had some disaster funds they used for it. They had researchers testing these materials, but then they also had commercial crabbers try them in their pots. And they recorded a lot of information, including how long each material lasted, how well it worked, did the escape panel open up completely, how many crabs were or other species were left after the panel failed, how long each panel took to fix once the material broke, and just how it worked in their normal daily operation. So we've been getting some interest in this, and our intention is to work on this study to find if these escape panels are feasible and practical in the commercial crab fishery. You know, they are required in several crab fisheries, including Florida, Texas, New Jersey. But, you know, in terms of poundage, we land a lot more than any of those states. So we would definitely have to make sure it'd be scalable. So we just wanted to see if anyone would be interested in participating. I know we had a few names last year we'll probably reach out to again. And does anyone use any of these materials on their pots already for anything? Do you have any information on how they work in the bay or the rivers or wherever you have your pots set?
Well, the only time I use ferrous steel wire is if it galvanizes mine, it wears off. And even if you put another zinc on your pot, it doesn't hold up very well. How many participants are you looking for?
We are in the very, very bare stages of this. So we don't have a number of participants yet. We haven't fleshed out exactly what material. We just want to let you know this is something we are going to be looking into. We would hope to have participants from various geographic locations because how long these materials can last can often depend on salinity, temperature, dissolved solids, even currents in the bottom in the areas. So anyone interested, we'd encourage to reach out, and then once we have this more developed, we can start talking about how it would work.
Do you have any idea about how long you would like to have, or how short a period of time you would like to see a disintegration of the panel? A year, 6 months, 9 months, anything like that?
No more than a year. Based on these materials, I think if they were replaced during the season, as long as it wasn't too often, it wouldn't be too burdensome. Again, that study in North Carolina, what we'd be looking to see is how long these take, how expensive they are to replace. And that'll kind of give us some idea of what our fishery should go for. And also, all the states we mentioned that have these, they allow for a variety of materials. So they might say the steel wire has to be this thick, the wood has to be this thick, but the twine, it gives all the options mentioned. So it can be that fishermen pick and choose which works best for them, which is easiest to handle, which they found lasts longer in their area. So I think by increasing the number of materials we test, it would give people more flexibility. And from there, again, we'll be able to see what our goal degradation period is. I don't know if, unfortunately, not much work has been done on this in Chesapeake Bay. I don't know if anyone from VIMS has recommendations on degradation time for escape panels. Rom, I don't know if you know anything about that, or Kirk.
Yeah. Or hand that over to Kirk.
Kirk, we're unmuting you if you want to. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Hey, Alex, this is Kirk. Yeah, there's done some work on that, but I think that one of the most important parts that came out of the North Carolina study, which I think would be important for the participants on the panel, is that those watermen were very concerned about the ease of replacement, in the sense that they did not want to have to take their gloves off while they're working out there. They had to replace whatever mechanism was on there. So I think that's something that you'll want to consider for this round as well.
Well, that's, yeah, their survey was great. It was very open-ended. What did you prefer and why? They had several options. They had, you can use these materials to secure the trap opening or to weave in to an open panel. And I believe the majority, if not all of them, said the pot lid was too hard to handle in gloves. So, you know, allowing for the most input from the fishermen, from the crowders, definitely gave the best results.
Yeah, this is Mark Sanford. I got a question. What is the cost of any of these panels that you're talking about? Do you even have an idea about that?
So I don't have any information on the MobJack binnacle panels, the ones that were tested before. Last I knew, they were testing a new design. I don't know where that's gone, but the twines, the steel wire, wood, I mean, that's going to be stuff you buy at the hardware store.
Okay, so basically I can go to the hardware store and buy the twine, the wire, and it doesn't have to be approved by the VMRC. Is that correct?
Most states required like a certain diameter, like it was, you know, 1/8-inch steel wire or something. But other than that, it's not, you have to use this specific wire.
Yeah, this is Kirk. That's the case. So you can get any of the stuff from your hardware store as long as it meets certain diameter or width requirements and, you know, material types like untreated.
Okay. And then my other question is this. Okay. So I go to the hardware store and they say it is within the requirements, but I go put this in my pot. Are the law enforcement officers able to confirm that it's correct if they pull my pot up?
They would probably be looking at the dimensions, is what I would say. Mm. It's twine. I mean, I don't know, you know, twine, if it's a twine one, how are they going to check if it's this twine versus that?
Yeah.
I mean, mostly they'll be looking at the dimensions, is what I would say.
Yeah, it'll probably be a minimum dimension for the opening, and then as long as you're not putting, you know, something ridiculous, some type of rope in, that they're going to look at and say, you know better than that.
Yeah. Well, what I'm getting at is I bought hanging twine for gill nets, and it's varying right now, is what I'm saying. I ordered 21, it looks like 18. You know, it depends upon the manufacturer. You know, so
I think that'd be...
That's kind of what's going with this.
Alexa, Gracie?
Yeah?
Alexa?
Yep, go ahead, JC.
Yeah, I tell you, I don't know where this came up again at. We pretty much, a couple of years ago, there was a pretty exhaustive research done on this, and it was pretty well proven this was not a practical idea. And, from all standpoints, the condition of the wire. And you can't even buy 18-gauge wire now. You can only buy a 16-gauge square wire or a 17-gauge hex wire. So, I mean, you say you want to give a year out of the bread box. I think, seriously, if you take a pot and put an oval and don't put a zinc in it, that it'll last a year, especially the 17-gauge. I don't believe it would. So that would cover the criteria. That you're looking for a year for it to collect grab box.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we beat this thing and beat this thing and beat this thing, and we don't have 500 people grab box for the Chesapeake Bay in the state of Virginia now, and the amount of pots in there, we just don't have that many derelict pots. I just don't think it's a practical study. It's just not going to benefit anybody. So it's just. I don't see why we need to keep beating this dead horse here, because it's not gonna lead to anything good. I can tell you that, other than more costs for the commercial watermen.
The study you're talking about, was that the I know you participated in 2017 where you were testing the Mopjack Binnacle panel.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, so that's why we're looking to kind of diversify to find more information out about these other materials, because I know some of the problems named in that study had to do with the specific design and how you attach the more rigid plastic type panel to the pots.
Yeah, the biggest problem on the commercial side is keeping the pots clean. We have to, in June, July, and August, depending on what you play about. But you do not get almost 7 to 10 days that you have to bring a crab pot ashore and have it pressure washed. These, I don't care what kind of panel or what kind of material that you put in the crab pot, they are not going to hold up when you've got a 4,000 PSI pressure washer trying to clean these crab pots. It just is not practical. It's just not going to work. I don't see any material that would hold up to this cleaning that we have to do, and you got to do it. I know we have to do it up here. I mean, it's gotten terrible. The hotter that the water gets this summer, it was 85, 87 degrees. One week to 10 days, you had to take your pots off and clean them. So, until they can prove to me that they can develop something that will withstand pressure washing with both fouling up, because you got to clean it. You don't clean it, it's going to foul up so bad it ain't going to do any good anyway. So I'm just against this from day one. It's just not practical.
Thank
you.
Can
I say
this?
Yep.
Go ahead.
I agree. It's just another expense for everybody. It's getting harder and harder now. But I know somebody who lost a brand new galvanized pot in a storm last summer or fall and found it this spring. And mine uses a brand new pot with zinc in it. All four funnels were completely gone within, less than a year it has been gone. The wire we get now is nothing compared to what it used to be. And I mean, like you said, I don't even think it holds up. I pressurized the sealer pots the other year. That was the worst thing I ever did in my life. It blew the galvanized off and it lasted. So I don't know what material would be any better or worse than that, but it's getting pretty bad is what we get.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything? I think was there anything from the public? Do we have any? All right. So that's the next agenda item was an update on the mandatory online harvest reporting transition. I think Adam's going to talk about that. Yep, we have you, Adam. Maybe speak up a little.
Yeah, hold on. Let me switch speakers.
Quiet, but you're coming in clear.
Is that better?
is the committee able to hear Adam?
Just start talking, Adam. If we can't hear you, we'll say so.
Okay. Is that a little bit better?
Can that's good.
Hear? Yeah, that's good.
Okay. That's great. So this isn't an action item, and this isn't something we're looking for a motion on tonight. But we did bring this item to you at the last CMAQ meeting, and what we're really looking for is not only to pass along information, but we're really looking to solicit information from this committee, as well as the industry as this committee represents. So the mandatory hard reporting program for BMRC is looking to transition bluecrab harvesting and reporting from our paper reporting that we've been used to since 1993 when we introduced this program, to a digital system which is available through our online application. This is something that we did for oysters earlier this year. Right now it's only voluntarily, but it looks like, but it doesn't look like it will be mandatory come January 1st. So during the COVID circumstances, it's even more evident now that we need to switch the system from paper reports to something more digital so we can get this information a lot quicker. I think some of the information that Alexa showed earlier that showed blue crab harvest really highlights some of the difficulties we're having with the paper reporting. We have, just for blue crab Lyme disease, sometimes 150 to 200 people with blue crab licenses who haven't reported their blue crab. So this does not really help us when we're coming to these committees and looking to do some kind of management action. You can see in this meeting right now, we're looking to open up that December season. We just don't have the data in the database, and a lot of that is delinquent. The information that we have shows that a paper report takes just over 90 days to get from harvest to in our database, whereas a digital report takes just under 20. So the information gets a lot quicker, and not only that, it's a lot more accurate. The information that you are allowed to enter in the online database really pigeonholes you into what areas are open, what seasons might be open, what licenses you might have, and really cuts down the number of errors, where those paper reports, if you've ever looked through them, or knows what people have found on them. So we're bringing this in front of the committee as a reminder that we are looking to transition to an online system sometime in 2021. The goal before 2019, before COVID, was to really look at a March transition date, March 2021. I think that's a little unrealistic now. So we're looking at probably some later in the year, 2021, maybe in the August range. This will give us time to really learn from anything that's going to happen with oysters and really do a better job with new crabs. So we're really bringing this in front of you tonight for two things, to see if this committee had any comments on it or any concerns, but we're really looking for feedback that you can give after this meeting, either by contacting myself or Stephanie Iverson, who heads up this program, who many of you are familiar with. We're really looking to flush out some of this, and we're really looking for feedback to make a product that is usable and more user-friendly for us. So I'll stop there and see if the committee has any questions about the transition plan or any concerns they might have about it.
Discussion now?
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah, if you have any thoughts, go ahead.
Alexis, JC?
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, I use this online reporting. Works pretty good for me in the area that I'm at. I've got a smartphone, I've got a computer, and unfortunately I can use it a little bit. But I tell you, I've gotten a lot of complaints from a lot of my members in areas that just don't have connectivity, that don't have the smartphones
you know, particularly up in the northern neck of Virginia, the Warsaw area, we got to come up with some kind of plan that these people will be able to do this. And, you know, I mean, a lot of the watermen are, you know, up in age, they're not computer savvy. There's a lot of problems in this. Like I said, it works good for me, but a lot of people it doesn't work for, and probably it doesn't work for more people than it does the good part of it. I know a lot of people down in, like say, Pete's area, down in Virginia Beach, Norfolk, Hampton, they have good connectivity down there. It really works great, but we've really got a problem in some of the rural areas. We've got to come up with a solution to help these people.
JC, some of it, I get a connectivity problem. Some of us down here have a connectivity problem, but it's mostly from the neck up.
Not to be.
I mean, you know, I'm just not so good at this, and I'm not against the idea of online reporting, but talked to Stephanie about this and Pat the other day, both at length. There's two things that concerned me. Number one was, if you don't have a computer or whatever you're going to do this on, the cost of purchasing that equipment, and then the monthly cost of internet, whether you have it or not. You know, internet costs me $75 a month, I think, something like that. So you're putting to a degree some sort of a cost burden on. So it's an infrastructure expense for someone. And then the other part, especially in my case, is I was going to take a course in this stuff early this year to try to get more proficient at using this, IT stuff. And the COVID prevented that because Amazon Intuit pretty much shut down their courses. So those are the two things. One of them is educational, learning how to do it, especially when you're not someone that does this very much. I couldn't log on to this thing today. I was just fooling with trying to get the download to come up again, but it wouldn't do it. And it's me. It's not the program or my machine or anything. It's my noggin. And I understand that, but, you know, if you're uneducated, uneducated, whatever it is. I'm just one that's not taking the time to really do this because it's not been that necessary for me. But as every day goes by, it becomes more and more necessary because I'm missing out on a lot of things. But those are the two biggest things I see to overcome is the cost initially for people that don't have it and the continuing cost monthly and the educational problem. And I talked to Stephanie about this in Pat, and I said, if you could give lessons, this would help. And Stephanie said, you can go online and call us, and we'll walk you through it. Well, that's okay. It might, you know, I might catch on, I might not. I haven't really looked into it much. But Pat said that right now, that you're not even able to even have a gathering because you would be breaking, I guess, a mandatory regulation out of the governor's office to even have a state-sanctioned meeting of that type to get people educated. And my only suggestion was, well, let's see what we can do in the meantime. Wait till this virus situation is over with, when you can start having a group of people come in, small groups at a time, and learn how to do this stuff. Now, whether you can do that or not, I don't know. The other thing for me is, and I'm going to go way back, when we first started this thing, a lot of people don't know this, but some do, but it was Jim Wesson and I and some others that initially started the whole idea of this licensing, and we carried it through the General Assembly. Harvey Morgan carried the bill for it. It wasn't anything that BMRC did. We did this on our own. We saw some fisheries getting out of control. We finally got out of Taylor Murphy that he would do a joint resolution and set a committee to do this stuff. And when we came out with what we had, I was the only waterman on the committee, which was not good, in several respects. Number one, because I'm me. And some people don't like that very much. And then the other thing was I was the only one on there. There weren't two, there weren't three. The whole rest of the people that were on there were sport fishermen. Because Taylor said the only way that he would have a commercial license was if the recreational fisherman had to have a license too. They're all started. But in the meantime, when we got down, when the bill went through and we got down to having to set up the program, most of us had talked about having a program similar to what Florida has, where they have a state trip ticket. And the reporting was done by the buyers or the self-marketers and not by the fishermen. And at that time, I had this guy, I think his name was Sanford, come up from Florida. He was the head of the Florida Commercial Fisheries Association down there, and he made a presentation to the commission. Now, he came up here on his own dime. Didn't cost us a penny. And we thought that that's what we were going to have. And one of the commissioners, I can't think of her last name now because of her early onset dementia. Her first name was Jane, and then there was another woman in the commission office that took this thing and ran with it and came up with this first little thing we had where your fish ticket would be run through a credit card machine that had raised letters on it, and that would put your number and card on it. That's why for a number of years we had that card with the raised letters on it. And then that would be the fish trip ticket. But it didn't have enough columns on it for something that gill nets or pound nets or something like that where you catch multiple species at one time, and there might only be a few pounds of it. I would like to see us eventually change over to the Florida system, and it's real easy to look up. All you got to do is type in Florida fish ticket program, and the whole thing comes up. And it even goes to the point where it shows you the guy that came up with the computer program and who he works for. His name is Claude Peterson, and it's Bluefin Data LLC, and he set up their whole program down there. And it would sure make things a lot easier for everybody. Most of their buyers.
Their buyers.
What's that? Somebody said something.
It was just an echo from you.
Oh, okay. Anyway, they've got, I think, 80% of their program now is online. But there still are people that just do the handwritten entries on the paper reports and send the paper reports in. The complaints that I've heard from people about going online on this thing are that mostly from fishermen that they can't get all their stuff on one day's trip ticket and they have to do another one and another one and another one. I know, for example, I go to Georgia Seafood on a daily basis to get stuff, and he's a wholesaler. He gets product from Kenny Heath in there a lot, and his fish ticket will be 20 items long. And some of the items in there will only be 5 pounds of this, 2 pounds of that, 1 pound of that, 3 pounds of this, and then you get into his main catch. And that's burdensome with this program we have now because you can't get it all on a day's ticket.
I can speak to some of those things.
Go ahead.
So I can't speak to the Florida program, so I won't really touch that, but it is something that I'll talk to Stephanie about and look at. One of the reasons that we are transitioning oysters, or have transitioned oysters, that we spoke about, can you see, is oysters is one species, and then blue crabs might be four or five, depending on if you have number ones or number fours, whatever it is you have.
Right.
We understand right now that... I might hit on some of them, Mark, so let me answer some of Pete's questions. So we understand that things like gill nets and pound nets that might catch 20 species, online really isn't the best option right now, so we are not prepared to go forward and make those fishing gill nets and fishing pound nets to go online at the moment. We understand that oysters is one species, and that's already done, and blue crab will be the next natural transition. The other thing to keep on right now is not being able to have people in our building. We understand that we're under different circumstances right now because of building closures. That's why we're not pushing forward with this right now. We're bringing it to the committee to get feedback, so that sometime in 2021, when we can open up the building and we can have tutorials,
that we can help the public and we can help harvesters get through this. Right now, we do have an online tutorial. We also have online mirroring, which you can call up and we can actually see your screen and see what you're clicking on and help you get through your reports, because your reports are probably different than if you're in a group setting with 10 or 12 other people. So right now, that actually might be a better option. The other thing that we would look at doing was to have our staff available by appointment either in our office or in the field offices, so that we can help you on appointment. If you could show up, they would be there the first Wednesday of every month. You could show up by appointment and we could help you work through and get these online. Those are all things that, because of COVID-19, we can't have people in the office and in the group, but they are in the plan to do, and that's why we're pushing this down the timeline. I think
what is your timeline going to be on doing this? Because you're going to affect, you know, a lot of people that are like me, you know, just plain old ignorant on a lot of this stuff.
So that's in regulation, and that will be enforceable come January 1st. So we're looking to learn a lot from poisoning, and that should help the blue crab community. What the exact date is that we're looking to go forward with, we're not sure yet. We're looking to see the feedback from oysters. We're looking to see how circumstances from COVID-19 change. And we're looking for feedback from this committee as well as the industry. So I can't tell you that we're going live with it on July or August or September, but it is something that we need to transition. The current program is extremely expensive. It's extremely slow. It does not give the data we need. And data typing is becoming a thing of the past. The data typing company that we use is the only one in the area. It's South Carolina Data, and has been sold 3 times in the last 2 years. So at any point.
I know everybody else needs to know this too, but and I appreciate every bit of that whole thing. I understand completely. And what my intent is to streamline this for you and me. And I think the system we have now is I heard Gordon Lee one time describe a phrase is a goat's. It's just way more burdensome than it has to be, mainly because its original design was flawed, and all we've done is kind of expand on that same original poor system. And I think if you're going to do this, you should at the same time be looking at streamlining the operation. I talked to Rob O'Reilly about this many times before he retired, and he said we need to go to the other system, of having the buyer to be the major reporter and not all the watermen. You know, number one, you're going to cut down your number of reports. Pat said to me the other day that he was concerned about it was not effective as far as checks and balances go, but the watermen are still, the commercial fishermen are still going to be required to keep their fish tickets. They have to have them, if nothing else, for state and federal tax purposes. So that's just a requirement. And what Florida does, I'm sitting here looking at a sample of it now, and it has everything on it, actual time fish, hours or days, areas, state, county, depth, feeder fathoms, gear fish, perch seine, haul seine, long line, hand line, trap, straw, gill, travel cast, bandit, or other. Number of sets, quantity of traps pulled, soak time, head boat, guide boat, charter boat, aquaculture, lease number, all that's on there. And then on this one page, they have about, I think, 8 or 9 lines on this one. I'd like to see one with a few more lines on it. And they print these tickets and give them free of charge to the buyers. And everybody gets a copy. Buyer gets a copy. Fisherman gets a copy. The state gets a copy. And then they keep it now because they have to enter it online. And what it has on there, it's got a species code, size, grade, amount of catch. And they have something on here that we talked about years ago. They have unit price and value. Then there's another thing, it's a DISP, I don't know what that is. And then there's a note place at the end that you can add some anecdotal information if you want. And right on this it says FWC copy, which is the state copy. amongst the other stupid things I do, I'm an independent car dealer in Virginia. And if anybody bought a car, everybody's got a car, when you buy a car in Virginia, you get a copy of what's called a buyer's report, which is your sales agreement. And in Virginia, we have a form that you have to follow, but you don't have a state form. You can have these things printed up, but everything has to follow that form, and the DMV takes them and uses them, and they're all the same information on there other than your business title might be on the top or not. Some of these things are generic. You can buy a generic form. But it's the same thing. The dealer gets a copy, the owner gets a copy, the DMV gets a copy. And then I think you have to have another copy that you put in a file that you have to keep for 5 years. You know, the federal government wants to look at that. Everybody wants to come look at it. Why, with the number of dealers, car dealers we have in Virginia, that we can't do this with the handful of Mormons which we have or something like that, I have no clue other than people have just dug their heels in and don't want to vary from the program that we have.
Well, part of the peak is there are a lot of states up and down the East Coast that have buyer reporting, and buyer reporting is extremely flawed. Virginia is, with our harvest, our individual harvest reporting, is the gold standard on the East Coast because of the way we do it. But going to buyer reporting would only be backwards.
Can I speak?
Yeah, one second, Mark. It sounds like, Pete, you have a lot of good ideas, and this is why I'm bringing it up. This is not something we're going to solve. What I'd really like you to do is contact the advisor and get for this information so we can get this feedback as well as from the
You took a lot of good ideas.
This isn't something that we can see through in one.
Well,
you know, 2 hours to be able to solve this. This is the kind of information that we need in order to go forward and build a better product. So that's what I would encourage you to do.
All I want to know is that somebody is willing to even consider it. And for 20 years, nobody's ever even been willing to consider it except Rob, and he couldn't buck the flood. So he finally said.
The place to start that conversation would be with the buyers
Stephanie and I had talked about it at length for years. There was this thing in JC on it called, what was it, JC, the Blue Plate Special or Blue Ribbon Crab Committee or something a number of years ago, and we discussed all in there about being able to just report from your phone. This defense league was all in on it, and the Virginia Waterman Association.
Virginia Industry Blue Crab Committee, Pete.
Yeah, well, whatever it was, there was a lot of discussion about it then, and at first it sounded like a good thing, and then by the time I got to looking at it and talking to some of the older members at a Waterman's meeting up today, there was a whole lot of people that just didn't know how to do it. So the idea ended up getting shelved. Stephanie and I agreed to disagree at the time, and she wanted to sound the fourth with the program that we have, and try to make everybody become accustomed to it, which is where we are now. And I think because the thing is so complicated and burdensome is why more people like me choose to just fill out the paper and send it in, which is a pain in the neck. I would love to be able to do it online. But the other thing is just damn confusing. I'd rather have something to...
Have you tried the online system yet?
Can I
make a comment?
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I did the online thing, and I'm going to tell you like this, worthless, to be honest with you. The bottom line is this, from what I found, you know, I feel like this. The buyers are more responsible than commercial fishermen. They are apt to using computers. They know what they're doing. And I feel like, you know, this is being forced down our throats. And basically, we need to step back, look at the whole system that we have in place right now, and maybe consider the Florida system or even North Carolina. You know, and we talk about it's not going to give us the data that we need of where you fish or how many yards you fish. or how many pots he fished. But the reality of it is, when I was down there in North Carolina dog fishing, they would come down there and they would ask me those exact same questions. So we need to reevaluate what we're doing up here. I think the buyers are more apt to using computers, and, you know, I'm going to tell you like it is. I'm not very smart. I tried the online reporting, and I was not very good at it, and I gave it up.
Online tutorial?
What's that?
Have you had a chance to look at the online tutorial?
No, I have not.
Well, we're already going on 2.5 hours, and so
yeah, I mean,
I don't want to cut anyone off on this, but it's something that we'll bring back up at every CMAC meeting from here. But rather than trying and solve all these things through the meeting, what I'd really like this committee to do is call Ms. Iverson and see the street that you talked to see with Ms. Iverson, so that we can try and get some of this feedback and try and make a better system before it goes live. That's really the key of why we have it on the agenda. It's not to solve the issue tonight, but it's really to make what the product we have better. So these are good suggestions.
I'm interested in making it better and making the data, you know, immediately available. You know, instead of having to even wait a month.
So
you know, if you're doing a fish ticket and the buyer's put it on the computer, all he's got to do is push a button and send it, which is all we have to do too. But instead of getting data from, how many fishermen did you get data from now? You're going to get them from, you're going to get the same amount of data from less reports, you know, less reporters, I should say, and require that the watermen keep their copies. I'm a self-marketer. I'm going to have to learn how to do it either way. So I'm not gaining myself anything. I just want to make the whole thing better. That's all I'm looking for. And I don't want to have to put in unnecessary burden on people that don't really have to do this and don't want to buy internet program, you know, internet service every month.
It's available on every cell phone and every tablet. When these COVID-19 restrictions change, we are looking to have it in office too. So that should really spread out.
Yes, well, hey, I've got great big hands, and my fingers are big as hot dogs. And I cannot do anything on my phone without hitting three things at once. So that's out of the question for me. I don't know how many people that are like that, but you know, a lot of watermen are the same way. And if nothing else, their hands are all beat up.
All right, folks, listen, I'm going to cut this conversation off because we are going in 2.5 hours on this meeting. You know, we'll have time to discuss this further. You know, it's just, Adam wants to just bring to your attention that this is what he's done with shellfish. And, you know, it's not happening tomorrow, okay? It's going to happen sometime in the future. You know, when that future is uncertain at this point. You brought up some good points. We'll look into those. And we'll be discussing this more with you. What else do we have on the agenda tonight?
I think just if there's any other issues the committee or the public wants to bring up that aren't on the agenda.
Boy, good silence. Okay. Is anybody on the line for public comment?
A few people are unmuted.
Everybody's unmuted. Does anyone else have anything?
All right, then is there a motion to adjourn, Mr. Chair?
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Sorry, who was that?
That was Pete
Nixon.
Okay. All right, then.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Looks like this meeting went really well on WebEx, so hopefully we'll be back in person for the next one, but I won't hold my breath.
All right, guys, have a good night. Thanks for
everything.
Thank you.
Appreciate
your time.
Thanks a lot.
Good job, Alexa. Thank you.
Yes.